Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. You will also find out what is happening in our world at the same time. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, our eyes are on Egypt, where a new president has just been elected. A lot of his time will probably be spent on trying to fix the economy. We'll have details. Then we'll visit some places in the U.S. where a new kind of technology is being used in the energy business. We call the program As It Is because that's the way we give you our world every day. Former Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi easily won Egypt's presidential election last week. Egyptian officials say he received more than 90% of the votes. During the election campaign, the former military commander promised to fix Egypt's economy. Many Egyptians have high hopes for newfound safety and a better economy. But Mr. Sisi is asking Egyptians to give up more, to make sacrifices, and he has warned them that it will take years to reform the economy. But how much are the Egyptian people willing to give up? The country has had 3 long years of political unrest and no clear economic program. Ana Mateo has more.
Egypt's tourist sites are known throughout the world. But these days, people are not lined up to see the Great Pyramids of Giza. Foreign visitors are not filling bus after bus for a ride to the Great Sphinx. Locals say the tourist industry, like others in Egypt, has been flat. Ahmed Allah makes traditional boxes and games out of wood and other materials. He says business has been bad since the 2011 revolution.
So actually before the revolution, we was working very much, and it was a lot. It was many tourists in Egypt. But after the revolution, we feel very, very bad because the economy in Egypt, it's not only the tourists. Everything is damaged and everything's fall down.
President-elect Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's ideas to improve the economy were already in play before the votes were counted. The government plans to cut aid programs and reduce the national deficit. But economic experts warn that this plan could cause more unrest. Mr. Sisi has called for sacrifices from the Egyptian people. To help the economy recover, he suggests they eat less food, walk more, and use less electricity. The president-elect says that under his leadership, Egypt's economy will improve greatly within 2 years. But human rights workers watching the situation closely say 2 years is too long. Some predict Egyptians may take to the streets in protest again. Mr. Sisi will be the country's 3rd president in 3.5 years. The other 2 were ousted after popular protests. Mr. Sisi has been leading Egypt since the army jailed former president Mohamed Morsi last July. Thousands of people have been killed or arrested since then. Most of those detained are accused of having ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. Even with years of social and political unrest, many Egyptians are willing to sacrifice for their country. Ahmed is a craftsman. He earns less than $150 a month and he says he can live with some sacrifices.
We need to work more, and we need to give Egypt more, because we can change the life different than now.
He says that he hopes some tourists will return to his market now that a real president is in power again. I'm Ana Mateo.
A new technology has brought a lot of development to rural towns on the Bakken Shale Formation in the northern United States. Energy companies use the technology to remove oil from the earth through a process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. As we hear from Ann Ball, the development brings risks and riches.
6 years ago, astronauts in space saw only darkness when they looked at western North Dakota and eastern Montana. But the area can now be seen from the International Space Station because of thousands of intense fires. They are the oil fields fueling a red-hot energy industry in the United States. Fracking has brought changes to North Dakota. It enables the removal of oil from shale deposits, like the Bakken Shale Formation. The search for oil deposits has increased activity in once sleepy towns like Williston, North Dakota. In 2000, the state's population was about 620,000. North Dakota State University professor Nancy Hoder says the population is now closer to 730,000.
It's a record high. It's never been bigger.
And the expansion continues to create jobs.
We don't have as many people as we need to fill all those jobs. And we've got high participation in the workforce.
And not just in the oil fields. Businesses are having a hard time filling job openings, from driving trucks to making food in the growing number of restaurants. Cam Holt owns a restaurant. He says there is a shortage of homes, which has caused a jump in housing prices.
80 to 90% of the people that walk through the door here looking for a job need a place to live. You know, at $1,500 a bedroom, even at the rates that we're paying people, it's still unaffordable. It doesn't make sense for them.
North Dakota has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. It also has one of the fastest growing income rates. But a labor organization warns the state is also one of the most dangerous places to work. The AFL-CIO says it has a death rate 5 times higher than the national average. Most of those deaths happened in areas where mining and oil removal projects are taking place. The work may be dangerous, but people continue to look for jobs in towns like Williston. Dean Bangsund is an economist at North Dakota State University.
Now we're seeing that technology is allowing us to put the wells closer together without affecting the performance of the wells. So the ecology and the technology and the economics is evolving.
He says it is too early to tell what the long-term economic and environmental effects will be.
This is a relatively new technology. It's being adjusted. It's undergoing tweaks and refinements as we speak. It's dealing with a portion of geology that the state has not traditionally dealt with. It's much larger, much broader in context.
It appears the promise of the oil industry in North Dakota will extend and continue to drive demand for a workforce willing to accept the risks and rewards. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Jim Tedder. Thank you for spending some time with us today. There are two more Learning English programs coming your way in just a few seconds. And world news follows at the beginning of the hour. This is VOA, Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Many schools across the U.S. hold graduation ceremonies this time of year. In some schools, even 5- and 6-year-olds observe their graduation from kindergarten, and so can older people, much older. Meet 70-year-old Jerry Reed. He just graduated from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He earned a bachelor's degree. Mr. Reed might not look like the average college student. His hair is definitely grayer. But still, Jerry Reed's age is easy to forget. Other UVA students know him as one of their own.
He's the coolest 7-year-old I know that.
Mr. Reed fit right into the WHO crew, a group that cheers loudly for the school at sports events. He also joined a fraternity, a men's group on campus. He sang drinking songs along with many other students.
From Rugby Road to Vinegar Hill, we're gonna get drunk tonight.
Mr. Reed's school friends say they can talk to him about just about anything.
You can relate to him just like that.
About a half century ago, in his 20s, Mr. Reed was not in school. Instead, he was racing cars and chasing girls. But he says his friend Bill invited him to UVA parties.
Bill Sturman just told me what a screw-up I was, that there was no way I'd ever make anything out of my life unless I came up here and went to school with him.
That was in 1963. Jerry Reed says it took him 48 years to take that advice. In 2011, he entered college. His last examination before graduation involved the Civil War general for the South, Stonewall Jackson.
Our next speaker is Jerry Reed.
His blunders were not as large as the enemy's in most cases, and astounding luck remained on his side.
UVA professor Luke Wright says Mr. Reed influenced students. Professor Wright says he opened the minds of the young adults. The teacher says Mr. Reed showed them that life does not end at 40. Instead, the 70-year-old college graduate believes that getting older can be the beginning of a dream.
Remember that path that you left waits for you. It's there. It's yours. All you got to do is get out of your own way and get back to it. And that's exactly what I did.
Mr. Reed says that he and his wife, Susan, now will take some time off to enjoy his college degree. Then he will return to UVA to begin studying for his graduate degree.
We still got parties to go to.
And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. For more education stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. You can listen to our reports at our website or download them. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. I'm Jerry Watson.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1850, the northern and southern states threatened to split over the issue of slavery. At that time, owning slaves was legal in the southern states. Many northerners opposed slavery, and the question remained, should slavery be legal in new territories in the western part of the country? The two sides disagreed strongly, but the issue needed to be settled. So Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise. Conservative Southern lawmakers rejected it. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina especially spoke against the compromise, but other lawmakers supported it, including one of the nation's top political leaders. Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts said the compromise was the only way to save the Union of States. 4 days after Webster's speech, Senator William Seward of New York presented his ideas to the Senate and to the nation. Seward was a Northerner. He said he opposed any compromise with the South. He said he did not want slavery in the new Western territories, and he called for a national policy to start peacefully ending slavery everywhere. Seward criticized Daniel Webster for speaking against abolition societies. He said such groups represented a moral movement that could not be stopped. He said the movement would continue until all the slaves in America were free. Seward then criticized John C. Calhoun. He denounced Calhoun's demands for a political balance between the North and South. He said this forced balance would change the United States from a united national democracy to an alliance of independent states. In such a system, he said, the minority would be able to veto actions of the majority. A few weeks after Seward spoke, John C. Calhoun died. One newspaper in Calhoun's home state said, "The senator's death is best for the country and his own honor. The slavery question will now be settled." Calhoun would have blocked a settlement. In fact, many lawmakers had come to support the idea of Senator Henry Clay's compromise, but they could not agree on which parts of it to pass first. Southern supporters were afraid that if a statehood bill for California was passed first, then Northerners would refuse to pass the other parts of the compromise. So Southerners wanted to include all parts in one bill. A committee of 13 men was named to write a bill based on Henry Clay's compromise. The committee had 6 members from slave states and 6 from free states. Senator Clay was named to lead it. 3 weeks later, the committee offered its bill. It was much like the compromise Clay had first proposed. It made California a free state. It created territorial governments for New Mexico and Utah. It settled the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. It ended the slave trade in the nation's capital, the District of Columbia, and it urged approval of a new law dealing with runaway slaves. For about a month, the bill seemed to have the support of President Zachary Taylor. But then the president made it clear that he would do everything he could to defeat it. Taylor did not think the nation was in crisis. He did not believe the dispute over slavery was as serious as others did. He had his own plan to settle one part of the dispute. He would make the new territory of California a free state. There, slavery would be banned. Taylor's plan did not, however, settle other parts of the dispute. It said nothing about laws on escaped slaves. It said nothing about slavery in the District of Columbia. It also said nothing about the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Senator Clay, who had offered the compromise, questioned President Taylor's limited proposal. Clay said, "Now, what is the plan of the president? Here are five problems, five wounds that are bleeding and threatening the life of the republic. What is the president's plan? Is it to heal all these wounds? No such thing. It is to heal one of the five and to leave the other four to bleed more than ever." While the debate continued in Washington, the situation in Texas and New Mexico got worse. Texas claimed a large part of New Mexico, including the capital, Santa Fe. Early in 1850, Texas sent a representative to Santa Fe to take control of the government. The United States military commander in New Mexico advised the people not to recognize the man. The governor of Texas was furious. He decided to send state soldiers to enforce Texas's claims in New Mexico. He said if trouble broke out, the United States government would be to blame. President Taylor rejected Texas's claims. He told his Secretary of War to send an order to the military commander in New Mexico. The commander was to use force to oppose any attempt by Texas to seize the territory. The Secretary of War said he would not send such an order. He believed that if fighting began, Southerners would hurry to the aid of Texas. And that, he thought, might be the start of a Southern struggle against the federal government. In a short time, the North and South would be at war. So the Secretary of War refused to sign the order. President Taylor answered sharply, "Then I will sign the order myself." Taylor had been a general before becoming president. He said he would take command of the army himself to enforce the law. And he said he was willing to hang anyone who rebelled against the Union. President Taylor began writing a message to Congress on the situation. He never finished it. On July 4, 1850, Taylor attended an outdoor Independence Day ceremony. The event was held on the grounds where a monument to America's first president, George Washington, was being built. The day was very hot, and Taylor stood for a long time in the burning sun. That night, he became sick with pains in his stomach. Doctors were called to the White House, but none of their treatments worked. 5 days later, President Zachary Taylor died. His vice president, Millard Fillmore, was sworn in as president. Millard Fillmore was from New York State. His family was poor. His early education came not from school teachers, but from whatever books he could find. Later, Fillmore was able to study law. He became a successful lawyer. He also served in the United States Congress for 8 years. The Whig Party chose him as its candidate for vice president in the election of 1848. He served in the office for about a year and a half before the death of President Taylor. Fillmore had disagreed with Taylor over the Congressional Compromise on Slavery and the Western Territories. Unlike Taylor, Fillmore truly believed that the nation was facing a crisis, and he truly believed the compromise would help save the Union. Now, as president, Fillmore offered his complete support to the compromise bill. Its chances of passing looked better than ever. Fillmore asked the old cabinet to resign. He named his own cabinet members. All were strong supporters of the Union. All supported the compromise. Congress debated the compromise bill throughout the summer of 1850. The bill included several proposals. Supporters decided not to vote on the proposals as one piece of legislation. They saw a better chance of success by trying to pass each proposal separately. Their idea worked. By the end of September, both the Senate and House of Representatives had approved all parts of the 1850 Compromise. President Fillmore signed them into law. One part of the compromise permitted California to enter the Union as a free state. One established territorial governments in New Mexico and Utah. One settled the dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Another ended the slave trade in the District of Columbia. Many happy celebrations took place when Americans heard that President Fillmore had signed the 1850 Compromise. Many people believed the problem of slavery had been solved. They believed the Union had been saved. Others, however, believed the problem only had been postponed. They hoped the delay would give reasonable people of the North and South time to find a permanent answer to the issue of slavery. Time was running out. It was true that the 1850 Compromise had ended a national crisis, but both Northern and Southern extremists remained bitter. Those opposed to slavery believed the compromise law on runaway slaves violated the Constitution. The issue of slavery was linked to the issue of secession. Did states have the right to leave the Union? If Southern states rejected all compromises on slavery, did they have the right to secede? The signing of the 1850 Compromise cooled the debate for a time, but disagreement on the issues was deep. It would continue to build over the next 10 years. How the situation affected slaves themselves will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.